If you'll allow me, I'll only mention that when Mr. Richter resigned from UNSCOM in 1998, he gave an interview to Elizabeth Farnsworth in the NewsHour, and he said the following as it appears on the web. This is 1998. The Security Council is on a gradual, even a steep slide downhill in terms of its ability to support or willingness to support the Special Commission. And there is no indication that anything the United States has been doing would turn the Security Council around. So as you can see, we have here a profound thinker and a kind of a prophet, which also gives me the impression that we are going to have some very profound insights and maybe some prophetic ideas about tonight's subject, which is the search for a peaceful resolution to the Iraq crisis in spite of the media. So please join me in welcoming Mr. Scott Richter.
Well, thank you very much for such a kind introduction. I'm not sure I'm worthy of such a thing. First of all, thanks for coming here tonight. I know you came here to see Robert Fisk, and having me show up instead is a little bit like coming to watch the Stanley Cup victors, and to have not only not the Stanley Cup team show up, but somebody who doesn't even play hockey show up to talk about it. So I hope I can fill in. First of all, let me note that I'm not a journalist. Now, I know my passport. I carry it with me sometimes. It does have in here a visa from Jordan that says I'm a journalist, but that was just so I could get in and make a documentary film in Iraq. U.S. sanctions prohibit U.S. citizens from traveling to Iraq unless they're journalists, so I had to become a journalist to do that. And I have had some experiences. I was hired for 5 months as an NBC News analyst on Iraq, and I was hired for 6 months as a Fox News analyst on Iraq. So whether or not that qualifies as a credential, we don't know. But what I would say is that my experience in talking about this issue of the media is more as an American citizen and a consumer of news, as well as somebody who dabbles in the provision of newsworthy information. I appear on TV. I speak before a camera. People watch. People consume. I am news. I am not a journalist. So that's my perspective in coming forward here and talking tonight. It's as an outsider speaking about an issue that I definitely don't have the depth of understanding of a Robert Fisk. But I will tell you this. I have an appreciation for journalists, and I have an appreciation for news. Why? Because I am a citizen of the United States of America. I am a citizen of a functioning democracy. I am a citizen who believes that it is my responsibility to empower myself with knowledge and information, because only in so empowering myself can I function as a citizen capable of making an informed decision about events around the world at home that impact on me and impact on my fellow citizens. One of the biggest obstacles we face as people, as human beings, is overcoming fear and ignorance. We live in a dangerous world. Hell, turn on the TV. Excuse my language. I'm a former Marine. Every once in a while I slip into these little four-letter words. I'll try and do my best not to. Heck, turn on the TV, and you can't help but be afraid. We have a war on terror. We are confronting a war with Iraq. We have a potential conflict with Korea. And I mean, the news media is not shy about this. I mean, turn on CNN and there it is, baby. Showdown with Saddam. Welcome to the Worldwide Wrestling Federation. In this corner, we got George W. Bush weighing in at 195 pounds, dressed in red, white, and blue. And over here, boo, his Saddam Hussein, the personification of evil. In fact, he's part of the axis of evil. Showdown with Saddam. It's entertainment, guys. turn on the TV and be entertained. It isn't news. And that's the problem. When you turn on the TV today, when you open up the tabloids, what you get is a gross oversimplification of an extremely complicated situation. And when you combine this with the fact that we are humans who are concerned about the world we live in, who are fearful about the future, and who, we should be honest, are ignorant about the facts, if we can't empower ourselves with knowledge, with truth, then we suddenly are no longer quality citizens capable of having an impact on how we are governed and how we are led. We become compliant sheep that can be pushed around by the government. And as an American, I think that's basically what's been happening in the United States for the past few years, especially in regards to Iraq, especially since September 11th. We are fearful. We were attacked. We have a war on terror. And it's a war that's not going away. We got Homeland Security now. And Homeland Security has given us a mood ring. And the mood ring tells us to be concerned, to be afraid. Orange, yellow, red. We don't know what's going on, but there it is. We are told we have an imminent risk, a high risk, but we have a risk. So we are afraid. Now, we don't know exactly what this risk is. In fact, when anybody has the audacity to say, well, what is the nature of the threat? We can't really define it. We have chatter. So we're afraid of chatter. We have Homeland Security. We have a war on terror globally. We're hunting down a man named Osama bin Laden. We can't find him. And because we can't find him, we seemingly divert our attention elsewhere, because we need to feel good about something. We need to feel that we're doing something, that we're confronting evil. So we have Saddam Hussein. And Saddam Hussein, of course, is a villain that we all recognize because we have been conditioned to recognize Saddam Hussein as evil. Ignorance, fear, these are our enemies. Knowledge, information, education are our friends. How do we as citizens empower ourselves with information? And this is the crux of the problem. We are dependent upon the media. We need the media. It's a tool of empowerment. And therefore, it's incumbent upon the media to be a fair and objective purveyor of news and information. If the media fulfills this role, then the citizens will be empowered with information and will be emboldened to function as members of a democratic society. See, it's easy to raise your hand and say, excuse me, Mr. President, I have a question. You just said X, but I know Y and Z. How do you defend yourself, Mr. President? See, we're allowed to do that in a democracy. This isn't Iraq. You know, in Iraq, I can imagine the average Iraqi citizen, excuse me, Mr. They're gone. See, they can't stand up and be counted. But what American is going to want to confront the President of the United States when they're ignorant of the facts? When they're told that a situation exists and there is no counter to it. I mean, when we're told that the world is black and white, when we're told that this is a struggle of good versus evil. But I think we all know from our day-to-day existence that the world isn't black and white. The world is a collection of gray, shades of gray. You have dark gray, you have light gray, but it's gray. The world is an inherently complex place to live in. We know daily life. I don't know what life is in Calgary. Maybe if Canadians have solved all the problems that we encounter in the United States, but I can tell you in Albany, it's pretty darn complicated. Just getting up in the morning, putting my kids on the bus, and getting ready to live life. I have a lot of decisions to make, and they're not all black and white decisions. Life is complicated, and it gets more complicated when you throw in international relations, when you throw in issues of war and peace. It's not black and white, and yet the government of the United States portrays issues of war and peace, of confrontation with terror, of confrontation with Saddam, as a black and white situation, good versus evil. You're either with us or you're against us. Of course, he says in the text, you're either with us or you again us. But, you know, that's okay. I speak Texan. But the point is, it's a gross oversimplification of a very complicated problem that we as members of democratic society face. We are dependent upon the media to provide us with information. And I'll be the first to say, can I find data out there that you know, has the facts, lays out the facts? Absolutely. I mean, if you want to spend several hours a day, and there are people whose job it is to do just this, wade through the myriad of tabloids, magazines, news shows, etc., all the data you need to empower yourself is there. But there's no filter. You don't have a filter that says garbage, good, assess a little bit more. You know, who are you? Who are we, the average citizens, to sit there and say, I believe this, I don't believe that? The problem comes that in the end, we have to go with that which we deem to be a credible source. And when you don't have that much time during the day, what's one of the most credible sources out there? The government. Well, we know better than that, but the fact is, when the government says something, we tend to have an inclination to believe the government, to say, you know, I trust them. When you have voices of opposition come out, such as yours truly, and say the opposite, and then those voices of opposition are attacked, their credibility is brought into question. You know, whether it is their personal character or their professional experience is immediately attacked. Suddenly doubt springs into your mind. And maybe you're not going to give as much weight to this. This is all part and parcel of the problem that we're confronted when we speak of the media and empowering ourselves as citizens. And yet, we have a responsibility as citizens to empower ourselves. We can't simply blame the media. There has to be a balance struck here. And that's, I think, the ultimate problem when we talk about issues of war, peace, and democracies. We can forego our responsibilities as citizens. We can say, you know, this is an issue bigger than I am. I'm just going to sit back here and watch it unfold in front of me. And that's fine. Stop calling yourselves Canadians, stop calling yourselves Americans, and start calling yourselves Germans circa 1930, if that's the life you want to lead. If you want to be a passive observer, you don't deserve the title citizen of democracies. A citizen of democracy must invest themselves into this democracy. There must be sweat equity. You have to give something in order to take something. To make democracy work, you have to work with the democracy, because you are the democracy. I know as an American, when I read the Constitution, and I take the Constitution seriously, as a 12-year veteran of the Marine Corps who put on the uniform, who's been to war for my country, has put my life on the line in defense of my country, I took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So I'm a big believer in the Constitution. The Constitution speaks of we the people of the United States, and I'm sure that Canada has a similar concept. You're a democracy. The people of Canada are an important part of what makes Canada. The people of America are the only part of what makes America. Without the people, the American people, we're not America. We're not the American democracy. So we, the people of the United States, you, the people of Canada, we, the people of a free and democratic society globally, must empower ourselves with knowledge and information. How do we do this? Well, the first thing is to question everything. It's a standard practice. It goes down to, you know, has its roots in local politics. Again, I don't know local Canadian politics, but I know that in the United States, every time a politician opens his or her mouth, you need to question what they're saying. I'm going to make the economy better by cutting taxes. Well, the first thing everybody's going to say is, well, if you cut the taxes, you know, how do we fund schools? How do we fund medicine? How do we pay for all this stuff? And how does that make the economy better? See, we're critical. We're asking critical questions, and we demand answers. We're going to go to war with Iraq because Saddam Hussein is evil. Okay, let's do it. You see, what happened there? We forgot to ask questions. We forgot to be critical. We forgot to challenge authority. And that's our responsibility in a democratic society, is to challenge authority, to ensure that those whom we elect to represent us in higher office are doing the bidding of the people. We have a lot of room to question here. I mean, let's just give you a case in, you know, a case in point here. Afghanistan, 2001, 2002, you know, after the events of September 11th. Go back and take a look at the media. I know that I couldn't turn on one of the famous American cable news networks without seeing a lot of so-called experts paraded before the camera who said, we know for a fact Osama bin Laden has acquired suitcase nuclear weapons. We know this. We know Osama bin Laden has made contact with former Soviet scientists and is developing a viable chemical and biological weapons program as we speak. We know Osama bin Laden is in cahoots with Saddam Hussein, and Saddam Hussein has transferred his weapons of mass destruction know-how to al-Qaeda, and there are factories, as we speak, in Kabul ready to produce this materiel. Day and night, this was paraded to the public, polluting their mind, influencing their thinking. You know, no one asked the question. Why? Because after September 11th, you weren't allowed to ask questions. You weren't allowed to say, excuse me, I got a question. I don't think that's true. Traitor, unpatriotic. How dare you question authority? Remember what the president said. In this war on terror, you're either with us or you're against us. Again, that Texan term. You're against us. So if you question, excuse me, Mr. President, if you do your democratic obligation to hold those whom you elect to a higher office responsible, you suddenly are attacked. So no one dared ask the question. Well, I did. I kept saying, look, I know all about weapons of mass destruction, how to build these things, and you don't build them in a cave. Osama bin Laden doesn't have the technological know-how. I know the people who researched loose nukes and suitcase bombs, and they don't exist. They're all accounted for. This is absurd what you're saying. Well, you must be an agent of Saddam Hussein. How dare you say otherwise? Immediately, the character is attacked. I don't have no problem with the media presenting this information. What I have a problem is when American troops got into Afghanistan, occupied the place, captured all the documents, captured all the terrorists, got access to everything, and found that none of what these so-called experts said was true, that it was all wrong. I won't say a lie. Maybe these guys believed it was true, but it was wrong. Where was the correction of the record? People coming out and going, oh, yes, Bill O'Reilly, Fox News. Tonight I'd like to just share a moment with you. You know, for the last several months I've been telling you that Osama bin Laden has nuclear weapons. Well, we now know he doesn't. I apologize. I'm wrong. I'm going on record. No one did that. They just continued to move forward. You see, to say they were wrong brings their credibility into question. And, of course, they don't want to do that because these are talking heads. These are entertainers. Entertainers have to be above, being fallible. They're not allowed to be fallible. Iraq. Pardon? Till he apologizes? Well, that's a good question to ask. Shall we wait till he has nuclear weapons? Till who has nuclear weapons? Okay, well, I'll tell you, we're going to have question and answer afterwards, and I'll try and do that. I have loose notes here, so you know. I'm a simple Marine. You don't want to distract me too much because we'll be talking about baseball in a minute. Let's talk about Iraq. I'm a believer in the rule of law. I'm a believer that we must operate within the framework of law. The United States of America is a nation of laws as set forth by the Constitution. We are signatories of the United Nations Charter. We have agreed to the principles inherent in the United Nations Charter, that we forswear war as a means of resolving disputes between nations. Regime removal is not an option because it's against the Charter. So I have a problem when the United States comes out and says, we're going to not only go to war with Iraq, but we're going to go to war with Iraq to remove a regime. Now, that's a complete divergence from the concept of the rule of law. So I'd like a little bit of explanation, Mr. President, why the United States is going to head down this path. And we're told that we're confronting evil. Problem number one with the media in regards to Iraq. The creation of the perception or the dehumanization of the people of Iraq. When you buy into the concept that Saddam Hussein is inherently evil and that the regime of Saddam Hussein is an evil regime, you dehumanize the people of Iraq. It's a gross oversimplification. And I have to tell you right now, I guarantee you this. I have more experience with the brutal thugs of Saddam Hussein's regime. I've been in more prisons. I've been in more intelligence facilities. I've seen more firsthand evidence of his crimes, I would say, than anybody in this room. So I'm not here to defend Saddam Hussein. But to grossly oversimplify the reality of the Iraqi government, the reality of Iraq, by trying to quantify it in terms of black and white, good, evil, to call it an evil regime is a disservice. And it should be insulting to everybody in this room. When somebody stands up and says, it's an evil regime, Oh, really? I thought it might be also a regime that built some of the best medical facilities in the Middle East, that under Saddam Hussein reduced infant mortality rates. It might be a regime that had universal education for not just men, but unique among the Arab world, women. It might be a regime that effectively used its oil wealth to better the life of the Iraqi people. Now, is this an evil regime? Or is it a complicated regime? Is Saddam Hussein the personification of evil? Or is he the result of an internal political dynamic that requires a Sunni tribal leader to rise to a position of power and use a variety of tools and techniques to control a Shia population that 60% represents the majority, a 23% population of Kurds that nobody wants to give independence to, and a fractious remainder of 17% Sunni Arabs who are a conglomerate of tribes and families that are feuding amongst one another. I think that's really the answer there. You see, it's gray. It's not black and white. And yet, you turn on the TV, evil. Mistake number one. Mistake number two. Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction and has used them against his own people, and he's used them against his neighbors, and he's a threat to international peace and security. Well, all of this may be true, but no one ever says why Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. Never goes into that detail of thinking. Why might he have chemical weapons? Could it be that Iraq was engaged in a life and death struggle with Iran, and that Iran was coming at the Iraqi front lines with human wave assaults, and that the Iranians were getting ready to replay a version of Grant versus Lee, to use an American Civil War analogy, where you're going to grind the Iraqis down on the field of battle, overwhelming them and dominating? So how do you compensate 45 million Iranians when you only had at that time 18 million Iraqis? The equalizer was chemical weapons. And it wasn't though Iraq was using them in isolation. A lot of people don't hear the truth that Iran had chemical weapons too. And Iran was using them too. I'm not saying that Iraq's use was okay. I'm trying to put it into a perspective. They didn't acquire chemical weapons to attack the United States. They didn't acquire chemical weapons to eradicate the state of Israel. Iraq acquired chemical weapons to equalize the battlefield in a war of national survival. Plain and simple. Why did Iraq develop long-range missiles? Because they had the same missile that the Iranians had, the Scud-B, with a range of 300 miles. But if you take a look at the map, you'll see that Tehran's 700-some-odd kilometers that way from the border. Baghdad's only 75 miles from the border. Iran can fire all of its Scud missiles into downtown Baghdad, and Saddam can't reach Tehran. So he lengthens the range of his missiles so that he can equalize the battle. Did he build these missiles so they can rain death and terror down on Israeli cities? No. Eventually, he used them for that purpose. But they were built to equalize a battle in a life and death struggle with Iran. Why did he develop biological weapons? Because in 1988, they made a strategic decision that Israel, because Israel had nuclear weapons, Iraq needed a strategic deterrent. And while Iraq was actively pursuing its own nuclear weapons program, and again asked the question, why would Iraq want a nuclear weapon? Who acquired a nuclear weapon first? Israel? Iraq. Israel did. Therefore, you have to understand that Iraq and every nation that feels threatened by the Israeli nuclear weapon will seek to acquire nuclear weapons until which time they are no longer threatened. Doesn't mean they're going to use the nuclear weapon to attack Israel. They're going to use the nuclear weapon to create strategic balance. The biological weapon is the poor man's version of the nuclear bomb. Iraq sought to acquire the biological weapon to have a strategic balance. Now, am I condoning this? Absolutely not. But you see, that what I just told you brings in an aura of complexity that's missing from the debate today. We are told that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction because it seeks to turn these weapons over to the forces of international terror. They can serve as proxy attackers against the United States of America. This is absurd in the extreme, but which journalist has the courage to stand up and challenge the United States on this issue? What happens is the journalists hear the United States say something, hear the U.S. government say something, and they repeat it like compliant parrots. And there's no thought process going in being critical of this analysis, or very little thought process going in. And what happens here is that we perpetuate the concept of Iraq as an evil nation, Iraq as a nation led by an evil ruler, Iraq as a nation that's up to no good. And when you define Iraq in this fashion, it means that there is only one solution, the ultimate confrontation with evil. And what happens is we create the perception of the inevitability of war. From the very beginning of the Iraq crisis in 2001, peace has never been an option. War has been the only option that has been discussed. It's always, how can Iraq avoid war? But they can't, because ultimately it comes down that the war is about the inherent evil nature of Saddam Hussein, and Saddam must be removed, therefore war is justified. And the media perpetuates this. Peace has never been given a chance in the media. Peace, you know, no viable alternative to war has been explored. I wrote a book in 1999 called Endgame, Solving the Iraqi Crisis. And in there I put forward an alternative to war, because if you go back and read, I'm very proud of this book. I said, if you choose the path of confrontation, it's going to lead you down a road to which there is no solution. Because confrontation means war. War with Iraq means that we're going to have to try and assemble an international coalition, and I recognized in 1999 that we aren't going to be able to do so. So it means we're going to have to go alone. If we go alone, we lose international support. We lose legitimacy. And then we have to occupy Iraq, nation building. It's a nightmare. There is no positive way out if you choose the path of confrontation. So I put forward the concept of choosing a diplomatic route, dealing with Iraq diplomatically, dealing with Iraq within the framework of international law. The media immediately dismissed this as unrealistic. They didn't even consider it. Everybody who reviewed the book said, not a bad book so long as he talks about inspections. But the second he talks about diplomatic option, well, it's unrealistic. This guy's smoking dope. He's off on another planet. We're immediately dismissive of that. No one was willing to consider any option other than war. Why? Well, it's tough to go against the U.S. government. See, the U.S. government had passed the Iraqi Liberation Act, declaring that it was the policy of the United States to eliminate Saddam Hussein from power. We took that policy, we made it law. Who wants to take on the U.S. government? Who wants to challenge the U.S. government? Who wants to be seen? See, when you challenge the U.S. government, this is the other problem I run into all the time, you're called a sympathizer of Saddam. That's a big crime, you see. When I speak out against America's policy, I'm a sympathizer of Saddam. There's some outstanding media outlets in the United States, the Weekly Standard, that wonderful magazine of Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, has me on the front cover. Me, a former Marine who fought a war against Iraq, put my life on the line, spent many, many days of my life working in Western Iraq trying to stop missiles from hitting Israel. Somebody who spent 7 years as a weapons inspector in Iraq hunting down weapons of mass destruction, who had loaded pistols put to my head, threatening to terminate my life on the spot because I was too aggressive, condemned by the Iraqis as a CIA spy. And because I dare say there's an alternative to war, I am now Saddam's American apologist. Is that responsible journalism? I think not. And while not every media outlet parroted this, not a single media outlet came out in defense of an alternative to war with Iraq. And that's what we face today. If you go back and study the media reports on the impending war with Iraq, you'll see a long time ago, especially the American media, deemed war inevitable. There is no alternative to war right now. It seems we are on a course for war. We can't turn this boat around. Too many American troops have been deployed. War is inevitable. The United States has committed too much to the Security Council. War is inevitable. France stands up to the United States. War is even more inevitable now. No one at once says, hey, let's take a time out here and consider the options. Is war the only option? Now I come back again to the concept of democracy and my role as a citizen. I have made it my cause since 1998 to seek an alternative to war as a means of solving the Iraqi crisis, an alternative that relies upon international law, etc. one of the reasons why I'm grateful to be here in Canada tonight is not just to talk to you about the media, but to talk about an alternative to war. I'm here to put pressure on the Canadian government in my role as a private American citizen. You see, I've empowered myself with knowledge and information, and now I'm taking action because that's my duty and responsibility as a member of a free and democratic society. I put forward a concept called 6 points for peace, and it builds upon initiatives that the Canadian government has already expressed in terms of reaching a compromise with the Security Council about Iraq. The first point is disarmament. We all agree that Iraq needs to be disarmed. We all agree that the Security Council has passed laws requiring Iraq's disarmament, and it's incumbent upon the Security Council to ensure that these laws are enforced. We must hold Iraq accountable to disarmament. But I think we need to understand that disarmament is a Security Council issue set forth by Security Council resolutions. The American policy in regards to Iraq is regime removal. You won't find any Security Council resolution talking about regime removal. That's a unilateral policy of the United States. And we are going to go to war with Iraq unless we can come up with an alternative to regime removal other than military action. President Bush has invested too much political capital into the concept of regime removal for him to back away. So we need to give him a face-saving mechanism to extricate himself from this problem. Hence the remaining 5 points of the 6 points for peace. Human rights. I think we all agree that Saddam Hussein is a brutal dictator. We all agree that he's committed massive crimes against humanity, and he's violated the human rights of the Iraqi people in an egregious fashion. One way to change the regime of Saddam Hussein is to change the Iraqi government's posture vis-a-vis human rights. Wouldn't it be nice if the Iraqi government would agree to allow Amnesty International back into its country to monitor the Iraqi government's human rights record? Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if the government of Iraq appointed a special representative, invited the United Nations Rapporteur for Human Rights back in, and engaged in an active dialogue to improve Iraq's human rights record and to monitor Iraqi compliance? Democracy. I think we all agree that Iraq would be a better country if they had democracy. But is democracy something that succeeds if you impose it, or if it's something that succeeds if it grows from within? Wouldn't it be nice if the Iraqi government committed to a 3-year program of joint work with the United Nations and international organizations to create opposition parties that are protected by the international community, and then to hold internationally monitored elections for the parliament so that you have a democratically elected parliament, and then to build upon that to create a true parliamentarian form of government where you have a prime minister at the head of Iraq? Wouldn't that be regime change? Peace. Wouldn't it be nice if we get the Iraqi government not only to agree that Kuwait exists as a nation state, but to recognize the borders of Kuwait, to forswear war with Iran, and, maybe most importantly, to agree that they will accept a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian problem that is acceptable to the people of Palestine, that if the people of Palestine say they can have peace with Israel, so can Iraq, and regardless to forswear violence as a way of resolving disputes between nations, and to forever say they will not support the work of international terrorists? Wouldn't that be a nice concept? The economy. We all know Iraq has a lot of oil. Wouldn't it be nice if Iraq guaranteed that if sanctions are lifted, that they will work actively with the United States, Great Britain, other Western nations, not only to exploit the Iraqi oil fields effectively, but to guarantee that Iraqi oil will be used to fuel the Western economic engine? And diplomacy. Iraq to recognize that in addition to its problems with the United Nations, it has a problem with the United States, and that it will actively work with the United States to resolve these problems, and a key to that will be the establishment of diplomatic relations. Pie in the sky, you say? Perhaps. But would it shock you to know that the South African Deputy Foreign Minister took these 6 points to peace to Baghdad in January, and Saddam Hussein has agreed to implement every single one of them? Has that been reported in the media? I don't think so. Saddam Hussein has agreed to implement every single one of these. Now, do we want to believe Saddam Hussein at face value? No. But should we give this a chance? Is it something that should be considered as an alternative to war? And the answer is yes, absolutely. And I'm here in Canada today to push this 6 points for peace onto the government of Chrétien, to encourage Bill Graham to pick up the phone and call Washington, D.C. and say, before you speak of going to war, have you exhausted every option to resolve this problem short of war? Have you had a hearing with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to discuss the 6 points for peace plan the same way you discussed going to war back in September? Where's the media on this? And this is where we have a responsibility as citizens. One of the reasons why I present this process to you tonight is to say that you have to take an active interest in what is done in your name. If you think that carrying out a peace plan along those lines would be a viable alternative to war, how many of you are willing to write a letter to the editor of your local newspaper? How many of you are willing to call up your local radio stations? How many of you are willing to call up your local television stations and demand that they give adequate coverage to this? How many of you are willing How many of you are willing to contact your government, your member of parliament, your foreign minister, your prime minister, and flood them with faxes and letters and phone calls demanding that the Canadian government give due consideration to a viable alternative to war? You see, are you lemmings? Are you little, you know, consumers that have wrapped yourself in a cocoon of comfort and you're so comfortable with your life that you let the government push you any way you want, let the media dictate to you the pace of information? Or are you citizens who are going to invest yourselves with sweat equity and intellectual equity into your democracy and demand that the media give due coverage to alternatives, demand that the media stop pushing war as the only alternative, and demand that your government break free of the trap imposed by the media and consider alternatives to war? Because the consequences, as the gentleman who introduced this this forum tonight said, are immense. This is not a game. This is war. This is human life. And a lot of human life is going to be lost if we give up to the inevitability of conflict. So again, my presentation tonight was on the search for a peaceful resolution to the Iraqi crisis in spite of the media. I've given you a viable alternative that has been embraced by the Iraqi government, that has been embraced by the South African government. Will it be embraced by the Canadian government? Will it be embraced by the United States government? If we sit back and wait for the media to influence these two governments, I think we'll be waiting a long time. But if we, as citizens, hold the media accountable, demand that they give due consideration to a viable alternative, that war is not inevitable, and thereby influencing the decisions made by our government, who ultimately report to we, the people. And remember, they work for us. At the end of the day, President Bush is my employee, and I'm holding him accountable for what he does in my name. And I would happen to say, believe, that Prime Minister Chetiyan is your employee, and you should hold him accountable for what he does in your name. So the key question is not how bad the media has been in covering situations such as Iraq and issues of war and peace, but how bad we have performed as citizens in failing to hold the media and the government accountable for what they do. Thank you very much, and I'll take any questions anybody has.
Okay, so questions, and please use the microphones, because if you sit in your chair, you're going to be saying important things and you're going to be raising important issues, and we want this exchange recorded. And if you sit in your chair, it's unlikely that we will be able to hear what you're saying, so please use the microphones.